Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Science. In this pandemic, we have never needed it more, yet in my lifetime, I don't recall there ever being so much misinformation about it, and with that, doubt. And that takes us to the Donald T. Frazier Outreach Center for Science and Health Career Opportunities at the University of Kentucky, where chances are very good you'll run across the center's namesake, Dr. Don Frazier. He's past chair of the Department of Physiology at UK College of Medicine, past president of the Kentucky Science Teachers Association, and past executive director of the Kentucky Academy of Science. Dr. Frazier, who has worked alongside Nobel laureates at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts, is here to talk to us about science and why it's important to our lives. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Frazier.
Well, it's my pleasure, actually. Science is something I just love talking about.
So first, let's begin with you telling us about the mission of the Science Outreach Center.
Well, our missions when we actually started the Outreach Center actually was to motivate kids, so that they would actually not run away from science courses because we need them to have some science in their backgrounds. It was also to empower teachers so that they could use the resources we had in the medical center, which was not available to them in the classroom. And also, I had a really behind my back of my brain, I had an idea that these people I'm talking to, the 140,000 of them we've had in the Outreach Center since we started, may end up one day being lawmakers or head of educational committees and things. And I definitely want them to have an appreciation for the power of education, particularly in science. Also, obviously, one of our things, when you gave the title with Health Career Opportunities, for the careers, obviously, we have six colleges in the medical center. All of them have wonderful opportunities for careers for our kids. So that was one of the things I wanted to at least introduce them to the possibility in their classroom. All they needed to do is get the credentials in order to actually pursue these careers. So we didn't try to force upon them their part in this, the role they have to play. They have to actually do work in the classroom.
What you're seeing happen with students, are they in any way being discouraged by the kind of atmosphere that I described before, the kind of political atmosphere out there that is a bit anti-science?
Well, actually, for our medical school and what's happening within those programs, the kids are there because, they're older and they got through it. But as far as the Outreach Center was concerned, we've had a year of almost devoid of kids there. So I didn't have any to talk to and actually play and make my day.
And what accounts for that?
Well, with COVID and the teachers have to come with us. They have to be able to come in a bus, and kids were, they were not in school. And then once they got there, there was still fear of travel for people that were not vaccinated. So obviously, them coming to our outreach center, I have been lost, actually. I've been just praying for them to show up. Now they're starting. They just now start to come back. We've had middle schools and high schools in the last month.
Okay. Well, this coronavirus pandemic has highlighted scientific uncertainty. The more we know, the more we know that we don't know. Is there a general misunderstanding, do you think, in our society of what science can and should be capable of delivering?
Well, I think one of the things that people don't understand is that science is not infallible. Obviously, in experiments we do, and we do our best, there are always, you can't take Tylenol, you can't take an aspirin, even though science has actually developed a drug that will actually, it will actually help us, undergo pain. You wouldn't want to go to the dentist if they couldn't put a local anesthetic in there to actually block pain. But what happens is that there are always chances for other things to happen. That's why they have to have all these little things that it could do this and that, but the probability is slight. I'll always tell the students, in terms of probability, there is a possibility that the brakes won't work in your car, but we still drive, mainly because we realize that the probability is very slight. And that's what science tries to do. We try to be transparent, tell them this thing will work, but there are always possibilities for side effects. And I think that's where the confusion comes in. is that they want science to be absolutely sure. And I can tell you, I've been doing science and neuroscience all my life. And one experiment always led to another, and we keep refining what we might think would be the ultimate truth. Some people are just impatient to want to know the absolute, and that's not necessarily going to happen, not in the research lab. But we try to make it happen. You know, we keep repeating experiments until the probability of being wrong is slight. But we can't get over that. And I think that's what people are worried about, is the possible this could happen effect if I take this vaccine. But the facts are pretty clear that the vaccines do protect us. And if we protect each other, then obviously we can get through this pandemic. And I can get people back in the outreach center.
Should we calibrate our expectations to take into account that fallibility that you mentioned and the ever-evolving nature of scientific discovery?
Oh, I think you're just spot on, Tom, that is exactly correct. Don't be so impatient because I tell you, this boy from Ice Plain Hollow in eastern Kentucky in Floyd County, I actually came up against a situation in my lab where I had some evidence that I thought would go against two Nobel laureates, which you realize I was against heavy hitters. And what I had to do with my science, absolutely, the results I had were correct, but the interpretation of those results needed further investigation. So I actually further investigated and found out that actually there was two answers to that question. And that always happens in science. We hope there's only one, result, but there are always some things because of our different biochemistries that we have in our bodies, things can react differently. I couldn't publish my paper because I didn't want to go against Nobel laureates. So I had to find out exactly another way in which they could be working, which we did. And that's what science is. We back up and we keep trying. But if you wanted me to do this in publishing the first time, I would have been embarrassed. Uh-huh. But we kept doing experiments. And science that I see is that I've been funded to do science since 1965. I've spent a heck of a lot of taxpayers' money from NIH, and I still have two grants going. And I can tell you one experiment leads to the other, and sometimes the absolute answer is, we have to wait a while.
I wanted to ask you about your work to improve science education, in particular in our coverage area, Eastern Kentucky. How are you working to improve science education?
As far as the outreach center is concerned, any teacher in Eastern Kentucky that wants to come and visit, they're welcome. We had programs where we bring kids in during the summer. We would bring teachers in during the summer and work with them so we can actually increase, empower the teachers actually go back to their classroom and actually be more up to date with what's going on in the world of science. Basically, it's being there, for the kids in that center, exposing them. Because in life, experience is absolutely the best teacher. Kids ask me what career they should pursue. I always tell them that first get some experience in these to see what it's like within those work areas. And then come back to me and we'll talk about how to move forward. Because experience is important to make the right decision. But we're doing all we can with pamphlets, calls, getting people in, going out. I'm now working with some of the counties where when they can't come to us, we'll go to them more and more.
How do you envision science changing or improving life in Appalachia?
The more information you have, for example, cancer is horrendous in the mountains, all kinds of them. And what prevention is the answer. And so the more information we can give, and I give it through the kids. You ask me how I can help. I can give when the kids come to the outreach center, I give them things to take home to the parents. It has to do with prevention and ways in which they can get help. And early detection is critical in cancer.
Professor Emeritus Don Fraser, namesake and director of the Donald T. Fraser Outreach Center for Science and Health Career Opportunities at the University of Kentucky. And I might note, at 86, he is still very much at it. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Fraser. We appreciate it.
I want 86 more years, Tom.
Well, let's hope you get it. When we come back after the break, in this era of too much screen time and too little time in the great outdoors, a look at environmental education.
We teach how to think and not what to think.
Tolkien's Lord of the Rings is a platform for environmental learning.
Tolkien invites us to reimagine the way that we relate to the natural world in some pretty fundamental ways.
Find out what goes on in a forest school.
We are dedicated to helping people spend time in nature, and we do STEAM education, which is science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics.
And when you're out there learning the ways of the forest and you encounter something wild...
Every animal is different. There are some general rules, though. Basically, leave them alone.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchtone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members and helping local residents through Co-op Connections, a benefit partnership between local health services and the cooperative that connects members with dental, vision, and other benefits. More at connections.coop.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
In this edition, we're exploring some science, and for the rest of the hour, our focus is on the natural world all around us, starting with Cynthia Reeser, host of our series on public education.
I'm here today with Brittany Ray, and she's the Education Director at the Kentucky Association for Environmental Education, and she's also the state co-coordinator for several curriculums for environmental education, including Project WET and the Leopold Education Project and Project WILD. Before joining the Kentucky Association for Environmental Education, Brittany was also a middle school science and math teacher. So, Brittany, first explain what environmental education is, and what's the role of your association, the Kentucky Association for Environmental Education?
Sure. Environmental education is really a process that allows individuals to explore environmental issues and engage in problem solving and take action to improve the environment. When you think of environmental ed, there are really five components that learners develop as they engage, like awareness and sensitivity to the environment and environmental challenges, knowledge and understanding, attitudes and concerns for the environment, and motivation to improve, skills to identify and help resolve, and participation in activities that lead to the resolution of environmental challenges. The result of environmental education is really that individuals develop a deeper understanding of environmental issues and have the skills to make informed and responsible decisions. So at the Kentucky Association for Environmental Education, we serve as the backbone organization for educators in the field, both formal and non-formal educators. So we provide support and resources to educators across the state and often serve in a connector role, like helping people to build connections and relationships among our educators in the network. We coordinate a facilitator network, and they provide professional development across the state in the national curriculum programs we host at the state level, the main ones being Project Learning Tree, Project WET, and Project WILD. Over the past few years, we've worked with a team, including a retired Madison County teacher, Vivian Bowles, and Dr. Melinda Wilder, the former director of EKU's Natural Areas and retired College of Education professor, to develop correlations for these programs to the Kentucky Academic Standards for Science. These programs are great resources for environmental educators and really showcase the power of environmental education. You know, environmental education and each of these programs are interdisciplinary, which means they include experiences for students in math, reading and language arts, social studies, the arts, and of course, science.
Well, describe for us what one of these interdisciplinary environmental education projects might look like for K-12 students. I mean, we can assume you teach science, but how can it fit all the sciences in as well as those other subjects?
Certainly. And this is something that often gets overlooked at first glance of environmental education. You know, it feels very science focused for obvious reasons. And sometimes the programs do lean heavily on science because of those very clear connections. But environmental education is much broader. One of the most well-known environmental education student activities is called ODEER from Project Wild. It's a learning experience that allows students to model and learn about population dynamics by looking at deer, which is very relevant to most students here in Kentucky. So in the activity, a portion of students become or model different essential components of a habitat, so food, water, shelter, while other students play the role of the deer in search of these components. And so this activity has a lot of physical aspect to it as well. Students get to run or walk quickly as they model the deer. And then as the population ebbs and flows, depending on resource availability and whether each deer had a successful year or not, students keep track of the data and graph what they're physically modeling, which brings in a compelling math connection. Students can analyze their data, you know, calculate the mean, median, and mode, make predictions about the population, and then apply that to the real world. And then to bring in social studies, you can look at the history of conservation in deer populations in America, what laws or legislation have been introduced to try and control the populations, were they effective? You can have students model the introduction of hunters in their simulation, and the possibilities are truly endless for how you can incorporate content areas outside of science.
Often environmental issues can become very political very quickly. So how do you address that in your curriculums?
Sure, that's a great point. The thing we focus on and that the education programs, the curriculum programs we host really drive home is that environmental education, we teach how to think and not what to think. You know, we focus on providing facts and scientific information, building critical thinking and problem solving skills, and leaving personal choices or stances on issues in the hands of the participants. So environmental education does not advocate a particular viewpoint or even a course of action. Environmental education teaches individuals how to weigh various sides of an issue through critical thinking, and it enhances their own problem-solving and decision-making skills.
And, of course, critical thinking and problem-solving are skills that can apply in any aspect of life as well as examining the environment.
Absolutely.
What are the most exciting new projects that your organization is involved in?
Last year, we launched a new program called EE Credentials. So it's an online set of professional learning courses that we call EE courses. And they're designed specifically for environmental educators. We built this program in partnership with a couple of other states who do similar work as us, and with Dr. Melinda Wilder as our education and design consultant. So we currently offer 9 EE courses ranging from Appalachian Mountain Ecology to Community Engagement Guidelines for Excellence, and with more in the works. It's been so rewarding to work with Dr. Wilder, you know, to design these courses in a way that can truly build the capacity of our field and spur continued professional learning for environmental educators. And we're continuing to build new courses, and we're now in the early phases of partnering with Eastern Kentucky University's Division of Natural Areas to offer some of our courses through them and create new ones together that can help extend the reach of the university and our program as well. And then our newest project that's really still under development involves working more closely with Kentucky school districts to plan and provide professional learning opportunities for classroom educators that are truly tailored from the ground up to meet the needs of teachers across the state. And we're very excited about that work.
Well, it sounds like your organization is doing a lot of work to make people more aware of how environmental education is more than just science, but it's a very interdisciplinary approach to help preserve our environment. How can listeners learn more or get involved in your initiatives or take some of your trainings?
Sure. You can definitely learn more about us by visiting our website. It's kaee.org, and registration is actually currently open for our next semester of EE credentials, and we have lots of volunteer opportunities and ways to get involved. So, yeah, check us out.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on Eastern Standard. I've been talking to Brittany Ray, and she's the Education Director at Kentucky Association for Environmental Education.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Among the environmental sciences, one field that has our full attention has to do with the recent storm system that sent terrifying, powerful, deadly tornadoes rolling hundreds of miles into western Kentucky. The Commonwealth faces higher risks from tornadoes and other extreme weather events in a warming world. WFPL's Ryan Van Velzer sat down with Claire Roth to discuss the science behind climate change and tornadoes.
Ryan, we've heard from a lot of people, including President Biden, who have said essentially that you can't connect any given tornado to climate change. What's the reasoning behind that?
Tornadoes, by their nature, are really difficult to study. They're these localized events that happen under very extreme and specific circumstances, and they're really short-lived in the scheme of things. Most of the data out there on tornadoes is really gathered for the purpose of warning people, not for the purpose of climate science. And that makes it kind of inconsistent in general for climate scientists. That said, there are at least three different ways that I've identified that climate change has played a role and will play a role in future tornado events in Kentucky.
Okay, so let's go through them. First of all, the warm weather. This is my first winter in Kentucky, but I'm guessing it's not normal for it to be in the 60s consistently in December.
Yeah, Kentucky doesn't typically see severe thunderstorms in December. The last time we had them was back in 2013 and 2015. Last Friday's weather pattern does coincide with a large weather system of warm, moist air coming up from the Gulf of Mexico. But that warm air from the Gulf of Mexico is the result of warmer ocean temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico. And warmer ocean temperatures are directly connected with the warming that we've seen all over the planet. In fact, basically, since pre-industrial times, the world has already warmed about 1 degree Celsius, a little bit more than that, actually. And every 1 degree Celsius of warming in ocean temperatures is associated with a 7% increase in moisture in the atmosphere. What I'm trying to say here is that when you have warmer oceans, it creates more evaporation, which creates more severe thunderstorms.
Gotcha. So man-made climate change has led to warmer temperatures, and warmer temperatures were one of the contributing factors in the storm system on Friday.
Right. Warmer temperatures put more moisture into the atmosphere, they put more energy into the atmosphere, and they make severe storms worse. And that was one of the factors that played into this unusual weather pattern that came through Kentucky.
Something that a lot of people have talked about is just how many individual tornadoes there were within this one storm cell. What did you learn about that?
So interestingly, the average annual number of tornadoes has remained relatively consistent since about the 1970s, but the variability has increased, particularly since 2000. And what we've seen is that you're actually getting less tornadoes, but when they happen, when these tornado systems happen, there are actually more tornadoes within the single storm system. And there's a clear trend showing an increase in the number of tornadoes in these bigger storms since the 1970s.
Finally, the fact that the tornadoes were in Kentucky at all is a little bit confusing to me. I'm from Iowa. It's smack in the middle of Tornado Alley, and this seems pretty far afield of the places that we typically expect tornadoes to be.
Tornado Alley is this part of the country that's always been associated with the Central Plains region of the country where tornadoes are more likely to touch down. Interestingly, since 1979, fewer tornadoes have been recorded in the plains and upper Midwest, and more have been recorded in the Mid-South. And Kentucky has seen among the largest increases in the frequency of tornadoes. What this means is that Tornado Alley itself is shifting towards the Mid-South. And in fact, I mean, the Mid-South has the greatest potential for increased tornado disasters by the end of the century.
So we might be seeing more tornadoes here.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
WFPL's Ryan Van Velzer, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
Kenton Senna is a restoration ecologist who focuses on reforestation of surface mined lands in eastern Kentucky. And Dr. Senna teaches a class in the ecology of Middle Earth. Yes, you heard that right, as in Lord of the Rings, using Tolkien to imagine transformative ecologies. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Senna.
Thank you for having me.
It might seem obvious, but let me ask, why Lord of the Rings as the basis for a class about ecology and environment?
It's a great question. To me, Lord of the Rings is an incredible imagined space with pretty profound portrayals of the natural world and the ways that humans can interact with the natural world.
And what are some parallels between that real natural world and the fiction found in Lord of the Rings?
There's lots of different ecosystems that we encounter in the Lord of the Rings. There's forests and grasslands, as well as ecosystems that have been negatively affected by industrial activity like Isengard or Mordor, or, spoiler alert, the Shire at the end of the book. So I think there's lots of analogs for ecosystems that we can interact with in the natural world that we see imaginations of or imagined portrayals of in Lord of the Rings.
What do your studies tell you about what can be done on the local level to move into a more sustainable relationship between humans and forest lands?
I think Tolkien invites us to reimagine the way that we relate to the natural world in some pretty fundamental ways. I might even say overhaul the way that we relate to the natural world. Tolkien maybe goes to an extreme that folks aren't maybe interested in doing in a way in which he kind of rejects some tenets of modernism and industrialism that we might not be comfortable rejecting at this point in our society. But I think Tolkien has, he imagines a natural world that humans live in, kind of within, and I think that's really profound. He imagines some elements of small-scale local agriculture and local land stewardship that I think are really important. And I think a great example of that is Samwise Gamgee in Lord of the Rings, who at the beginning of the book is clearly identified as a gardener, and kind of throughout has some pretty strong connections to gardening and cooking, which are both very like naturally embedded activities. And then at the end of the text, Sam is the one who takes the Lady Galadriel's gift and restores the Shire. He plants trees all over the Shire where trees had been cut down. And he kind of spearheads the restoration of the ecology of the Shire in a very urban forestry kind of way.
Well, it's downright odd, isn't it? I mean, we are mammals, yet we humans tend to hold ourselves apart from the rest of the living environment.
Yeah, and I think Tolkien invites us to reimagine that. I think he invites us to think of ourselves not as wholly distinct from or wholly other from the rest of the natural order, but to see ourselves as more connected to our ecosystems. And I think you really see that when the hobbits first go into the old forest and they have a conversation with Tom Bombadil. And unfortunately, Bombadil doesn't make it into the movies. So if you've only seen the movies, you won't know who I'm talking about. But he invites them to think about the trees and the things that live in the forest in a way that's really transformative for them, because the hobbits had never really thought about the trees of the forest as their own living things with their own kinds of needs and life cycles and life histories and so on. So yeah, I think there's a lot of room for us to grow in our imagination of ourselves in the context of our ecosystems. And I think one thing that's really problematic about our particular kind of public discourse that I hear sometimes is the idea that the best natural space is the humanless natural space. I don't think that's a very productive way to think about human-environment interactions and relationships. So I think Tolkien's invitation to imagine a beautiful and productive and harmonious human-connected or human-inhabited natural space is a really productive way to go.
Well, you know, initiatives are underway to restore former mine sites to something resembling their original natural state. And so do these lands then become off-limits to human activities, or are there ways to make them productive without destroying them in the process?
Yeah, and that's a great question, I think. I know you've had other folks who are doing work in mine land reforestation on the show, and Green Forest's work, I think, is a great example of an organization that's doing some really important work in reforesting mine lands in Appalachia. And I'm really excited by their work and excited to see how that continues to proceed over time. And students from my class did get the chance to get out on a service mine and plant some trees in partnership with Green Forest's work. That was a really impactful experience. I think that those sites can definitely be, as of now, and in my understanding of those sites, they're often part of public lands, like national forests and state wildlife management areas and those sorts of publicly managed lands. So those are accessible to the public for recreation and so on. I think that's a great use for those sites, for people to be able to get out in and enjoy those forested sites. I think there's lots of room for us to grow. Maybe the next phase in our growth and kind of thinking about and advancing restoration of these sites is to work towards maybe the next step in restoring the total ecosystem, including some of the non-timber forest products like mushrooms and ginseng and other sorts of species that are really important for foraging and livelihoods in Appalachia.
Part of the discussion about Eastern Kentucky's future, its economic future, revolves around ecotourism. And I would think that the restoration of those natural lands, especially the public lands that you just mentioned, would be essential to succeeding.
I think anyone who's seen a service mine site will recognize it as pretty distinct from the pre-mining forested condition. And I don't think it's distinct in a positive way. I think it's a downgrade from the pre-mining condition for the most part. So, I think if we want to see Appalachia transition into a region that really attracts ecotourism on a meaningful scale, I think dealing with those degraded sites will have to be part of that package.
Well, what do you hope your students will take away with them after experiencing your class?
I hope that they are re-enchanted. I hope that they can start to look at the spaces and things around them, the living things around them, including the trees and other plants and birds and other animals. I hope that they can start to see them as their own things with a life of their own, just like the hobbits, when they went to the Old Forest, started to see the forest as its own thing, with its own complexity and diversity and of experience and needs and abilities and performance and practice. And I hope that they can have that lens in their own lived life as they're walking around on campus and at home and so on, going to the woods. I hope that they can be re-enchanted in their experience of those spaces.
It's University of Kentucky restoration ecologist Kenton Senna. Thank you so much, Dr. Senna.
Thank you so much.
Sparking curiosity about the natural world can begin at a very early age. That's one of Hannah Harris's aims at the Red Oaks Forest School in Stanton, a nonprofit co-founded with Tina Brower. Hannah holds a master's degree in conservation biology and sustainable development, and she's written articles intended to demystify science and technology. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Hannah.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First, a little bit of background. Tell us about your love for Eastern Kentucky. What's behind that?
Well, I'm originally from North Carolina, but I moved to Kentucky to study recolonizing black bears in Eastern Kentucky. And I spent a few years living in Harlan and Letcher counties, and I just absolutely fell in love with the area, the people I met, the natural beauty. It's just an amazing, amazing place.
What is the Red Oaks Forest School, and is it a nonprofit?
Yes, Red Oaks is a nonprofit. And we are dedicated to helping people spend time in nature, and we do STEAM education, which is science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. And time in nature might seem like sort of a basic thing, like why would you have a whole nonprofit around that? But it's actually really lacking in most people's lives. And we offer a variety of educational programming options, and we just kind of try to provide a space for people to connect and build community.
Well, you know, I said in the introduction that with screen time being what it is these days, I would say that that's a missing element in many people's lives, many children's lives. Do you find that more so today than maybe a couple decades ago?
Yeah, I really think so. I think when you talk to most adults, they can tell you stories of playing outside with their friends mm-hmm. and roaming and, you know, being out there in nature. And most people will tell you maybe about a particular place that they used to like to go and visit. And maybe it wasn't anything that seemed particularly glamorous to adults, but for them as children, it was kind of a whole world that they could really just lose themselves in. And there's all kinds of important things that are happening for kids when they spend time outside, you know, from physical activity, which is really important and lacking in a lot of people's lives, but also learning cooperation and problem solving and all of this. And kids are not getting as many chances to do that. But then when you look, you mentioned screen time, and often the kinds of games that kids are playing are things that are really around exploration and adventure or building. So those urges are all still there, but meeting them in the real world is a really important part of that. So we try to provide that opportunity for kids to actually get out and do a lot of these kinds of things.
Well, I mentioned that the school is located in Stanton, and that's correct, right?
Yes, yes. We have a wonderful campus in Stanton, Kentucky. But we also offer some classes in locations that are closer to Lexington, including Raven Run. And we're partnering with a philanthropist in Lexington to offer some more programming on the Lexington side of Madison County. And we're going to be posting more updates about that as it unfolds.
Okay. And that was the announcement I alluded to, too. And so that's going to be coming soon. And as I understand it, basically you're using the Red River Gorge as your classroom.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. We're really fortunate to have a campus that has a large variety of different little ecotype zones. We've got a pond, we've got a big creek, we've got a small creek, we've got a meadow, we've got cliffs, and all of these different elements that make Eastern Kentucky so special. So we can go and have different lessons in different places and, you know, compare and contrast some of the things kids are seeing around the campus. It's a really special place.
Well, I was checking out your website, and I see that you offer a variety of courses, I think 11 total, and I'd like to look at a few of those, and anybody listening who wants to see them all can, of course, visit that site, which is Red Oaks Forest School, one word, redoaksforestschool.org. So first, there's a course titled Mighty Acorns. What's that about?
So Mighty Acorns is our forest preschool, and that is a program for 3 to 6 year olds. It is loosely structured. We have some circle times and songs and a theme each week that the kids get to explore, but there's also just a lot of time for free play and child-led exploration around the site. And that's the most conventional forest school of all of our programs in terms of comparing it to forest schools in other places.
How about nature classes? What's covered in that one, and who can attend those?
So our nature classes are for all, and this is one of the things that makes us unusual, I think, as a forest school, is that we do offer programs for all ages. We have programs for basically crawlers all the way on up into adults, and we have a lot of programs that are for families because we feel like family and community is a big part of what we do. So we have family nature classes where there's going to be a different theme each week. You know, we might look at tracking, we might look at pollinators or something like that, where people kind of can explore those things and we'll have resources for them. And we take a similar themed approach with our homeschool days programs, where each week we're looking at something to do with the diversity or the beauty of the Eastern Kentucky landscape. And we try to take a multidisciplinary approach in all of our programs. So we're looking at, you know, science and ecology, as you might imagine, but we're also weaving in nature journaling. We've got literature, we've got art, we've got games that are all supporting these concepts.
Would you say that this would be a really good experience for kids with ADHD or learning disorders or maybe somewhere on the autism spectrum?
Yes, I really think so. And that's a topic that's really, really close to my heart. I think for all kids that the parameters of just how to be a kid are getting narrower and narrower, and kids have less and less free time, and there are more and more expectations of them. And that's going to be particularly hard on kids who have other specific struggles. Even the kid who's struggling to sit still for a long period of time, or they may have a hard time staying emotionally regulated in a classroom environment that's really a little overwhelming for them. And when you feel like you can't be successful, no matter how hard you're trying, like that takes a real psychological toll on children, and a lot of them kind of stop trying. And programs like Red Oaks can offer a much wider space, kind of literally and figuratively, for kids to exist and to be successful. There's just so many opportunities to do different kinds of things and excel in different kinds of ways, and you can take a little breathing room when you need it. I definitely think that's like one of the most rewarding things for me personally, is seeing kids kind of gaining confidence in themselves and their own abilities and being supported by peers in ways that they might not have experienced before. So you mentioned ADHD, and you can have a kid who maybe is really fidgety and they have a hard time with impulse control, and maybe they've been getting into problems with that with adults and with other kids. And then you get them outside and now they can move around, and maybe they get into skipping stones because, you know, at forest school, you can throw rocks. And there's now a positive place for them to channel that energy, and they're practicing and they're getting better, and other kids are seeing them get better. And then maybe the other kids are asking for input and suggestions. And suddenly they've gone from being a problem child to someone who has a skill and is being recognized as a leader, which is just an amazing transformation.
Well, I mentioned that you're located in Stanton, and you'll soon have another location in northern Madison County. So let's say that you're hearing this in Lexington or Richmond. It means a parent would need to take time to make the trip. What can parents do while their kids are in class?
For parents who don't live in the Stanton area, and we do have some families who do, but for those who don't, as we get people coming in from all over, if people love to hike themselves, there's a lot of great trails in that area. Our campus is located on land run by the Wilds Cabin Rental, so people who enjoy spending time there can check them out. There's a lot of great opportunities for recreation in the gorge. There's a lot of rock climbing. There's a coffee shop in Stanton where people, you know, who just need some Wi-Fi to get some work done can go. But honestly, what I see the most, a lot of parents just enjoy spending a little quiet time around our campus to write or draw or chat with other parents and have a little downtime themselves. And they're, of course, welcome to do that.
That sounds really nice.
Yeah. We do want to make our programming more accessible for people who don't live near Stanton or who work on weekdays or kids who go to school full time. So that's why we are trying to expand our offerings closer to Lexington and offer some more things on weekends and in the summer so kids in that situation can still attend.
Mm-hmm. Is there a fee, and do you offer scholarships?
Yes, there are fees for our programs, but 20% of our revenue goes into scholarships and financial aid, and we are always looking for opportunities to increase that. As I say, access is one of our core values, and we think that everybody deserves the opportunity to participate in programs like this. So we do everything we can to make that possible for anybody who's interested.
Do you operate on the semester system? Is there like a winter session, summer session? How does that work?
So for a lot of our programs, we have a fall session and a spring session, but we also have summer sessions, and then we have a lot of one-off activities. Maybe we'll have a hike here or a bird watching outing or something like that that kind of go and extend year-round. And for people who maybe aren't in the area at all or, you know, can't participate, we sometimes have online classes, and we have a neighborhood nature program, which is a series of downloadable unit studies on different topics, and that's designed specifically for families to get to know the nature that's the most accessible to them. Because although we do love getting people out in the woods and experiencing all of this wonderful land that Eastern Kentucky has to offer, sometimes that's not feasible. And a lot of these same lessons and these same activities can be done in a neighborhood, in a park, in your backyard.
All right, that's Hannah Harris, co-director of Red Oaks Forest School based in Stanton. Thank you so much, Hannah.
Thank you.
What should you do if you're out hiking in, say, the Red River Gorge or some other Kentucky forest, and you cross paths with a coyote, a gray fox, a black bear, maybe a bobcat? Or maybe you're vacationing in Florida and there's a big alligator over there. Or you're skiing in the Rockies and you cross paths with a huge moose Or you're at the beach, frolicking in the surf, and somebody yells, "Shark!" What about bats? What about snakes? What do you do in these situations? Well, the question occurred to Rachel Levin, and she has written a book about that. Rachel Levin, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Rachel, your book, Look Big and Other Tips for Surviving Animal Encounters of All Kinds. Did you have an encounter yourself that led to the idea of writing the book?
I, of course, did have a variety of encounters that kind of collectively led me to write this book, Look Big. From raccoons rummaging in my trash can, to ants in my kid's cereal, to a growing fear of encountering a mountain lion while trail running around here in California. But then I almost cross-country skied into a moose in Colorado. And I had no idea that moose were dangerous. I'm outdoorsy, but I grew up in Boston, live in California. We don't really have moose. And so I was looking at this giant creature in the woods and luckily did not get mauled because turns out moose are pretty much more dangerous than grizzly bears. So
really?
I thought if I didn't know what to do about moose, more other people didn't either. And then I decided to write this book.
Well, what does a moose tend to do? Does it run you down?
Does it? It could charge you. I turned my back, which is not what you're supposed to do.
Huh.
And I cross-country skied away, got back to the couch. My husband said, that moose could have charged you. And I said, oh, I had no idea. So really, though, you know, you want to back away slowly and just kind of, you know, you actually could potentially outrun a moose, but, you know, you don't want to get into that situation.
Probably best just not to. So as you say in the introduction, there are recommended ways to respond in each of these situations, but it can be kind of confusing, even contradictory. So what did you find in that regard as you researched for the book?
Yeah, I mean, that's also partly why I wrote the book, is because all these tips, you have them in your mind or you see them on the trail signs, but they're always kind of jumbled. And I couldn't remember, what do I do if I see a bear? Do I look big? Do I play dead? You know, it's all sort of out there, but I wanted to know for sure. So it really does depend what animal you encounter, what to do. And I covered 50 animals in North America, and every animal is different. There are some general rules, though, basically. Leave them alone.
Sure. Well, let's look at some of the critters that can be found here in our neck of the woods. Black bears, for example. What is the smart thing to do if you run across one in the woods?
Well, that's everyone's fear, isn't it? Bears and sharks are kind of those big ones we fear. But really, we don't need to fear them. They don't really want to bother us. They really, really don't. But you're lucky, too, that you have black bears and you know, those tend to be, you know, one woman out here in Lake Tahoe who encounters a lot of bears and runs a nonprofit that kind of deals with them. She says bears are just big chickens. So if you see one in your backyard or on your deck, shoo them away. But if you see one on the trail, you know, that's their turf and you need to respect them. So basically you want to read the situation and make sure most likely the bear is not acting predatorily. It's mostly more spooked than you are. So in general, you want to, you know, just kind of back away slowly and retreat gradually. Don't really avoid eye contact and just appear as unthreatening as you know you are.
And of course, I guess that's multiplied by a factor of 10 if it's a mama bear with cubs.
Oh, yeah. That's what you don't really want to encounter. But, yeah, definitely steer clear and don't, you know, this whole picture is getting close to get photos. I wouldn't bother, you know, take it in with your eyes and walk away slowly.
Same rules for, say, a bobcat?
Bobcats, people are afraid of bobcats for some reason. They really, I think, are the least likely thing ever to bother you. I mean, they'll just dart before you barely can tell what it is. A lot of people see a bobcat, and if you're in mountain lion country, think it's also a mountain lion or a cougar. But most likely it's a bobcat. And you can tell by its little tail, which is usually just like 6 inches long and only like 30 pounds. I mean, really, if you see a bobcat, it will dart away before you barely even see it. If it doesn't, something's wrong with it. Could be a rabid. Then just get out of its way.
It's very true. The rule of thumb has always been, I don't bother them, they won't bother me, pretty much.
Exactly. And that's basically most animals, especially snakes. I don't know if you have rattlesnakes out there.
Yeah, yeah. And many people are afraid of snakes, often because they think they're all venomous. But of the 32 types of snakes that we have here in Kentucky, only four are. The copperhead, the western cottonmouth, the timber rattlesnake, and the western pygmy rattlesnake. You focus on rattlers. Tell us what you've learned about them.
Yeah, I mean, basically most incidents with rattlesnakes come when you don't leave them alone, or even of snakes. So you give it a wide berth. I mean, don't, you know, kids especially, oh, it's a snake. Don't let your kids start poking any any rattlesnake. But just give it a wide berth. I think so. You have to, you know, you're going off into the woods. You have to pee or something. I would just throw some pebbles before you kind of step in off the trail, just to make sure that, you know, if it's there, it kind of knows you're there. And you know, it will have a peek under a log before you sit on it or shake out your sleeping bag. Don't use earbuds when you hike. I mean, that's a general rule too, because you want to hear the rattle and you want to be alert out there.
You sure do. Well, really interesting to me is what we find on page 140 of your book, your listing of animals from most to least deadly. The black widow spider is on there, alligators, sharks, but they're among the least deadly. What animals are the most deadly?
Yeah, this was surprising to me. I thought, you know, I thought it would be fun to just kind of rank it so we can just sort of put our fears and anxieties in check. And the animal that is the most deadly in America is one you see constantly every day that you think is so docile. And it is, unless you run into them with your car. Deer. Deer kill on average around 200 people a year in this country, and mostly in car accidents. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some in Ashland, Oregon, I did hear about some deer that attack people, but that's really rare.
We do have a lot of car deer encounters here. And a few years ago, I had one myself, so I decided to have the state police on the air to talk about it and what you do in that kind of situation. And I was surprised. The trooper I talked to said, if you have time, if you can think of it, don't hit your brakes, because if you do, it throws the front end of your car down.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
that deer is
mm-hmm.
going to come right through your windshield.
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive. You don't want to slow down. You don't want to brake, and you don't want to swerve, because the car coming on the opposite side is more deadly too. So it's not what your human reaction is going to be, but that's what you're supposed to do. I'm glad you survived that.
Yeah, me too. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for your book and for sharing some of this insight with us. We really appreciate it, and I'm sure folks who are going to trek out in the Red River Gorge or part of the Daniel Boone Forest here in our area will want to pick up a copy. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Rachel Evans, she's author of Look Big and Other Tips for Surviving Animal Encounters of All Kinds. It's published by 10 Speed Press. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Wendy Barnett, producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, and on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.